Welcome to Behind the Podium, a podcast series brought to you by Fusion Learning Partners that lets you hear what speakers are saying before or after the podium mic is turned on. Join me, your host, Jasper Appleton, to find out what makes these speakers tick and find out new insights on topics that matter to you on each episode of Behind the Podium. Welcome back to the 11th episode of Behind the Podium. I'm your host, Jasper Appleton, and with me today is Thomas Fisher. Thomas is the director of Minnesota Design Center and an expert in urban design. He's written books such as Designing Our Way to a Better World, The Architecture of Ethics, and a brand new one underway based off of our pandemic. Thomas, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Happy to be here.
Absolutely. And so to start off, can you tell the listeners a little bit about your background and how you started to get interested in a topic as important as urban design and design thinking?
Well, I was educated as an architect. I also did graduate work in the humanities, and I've long been interested in how the built environment reflects our values as a society and how those values shape the way our environment works. So I've long been interested in urban design, even though I'm trained in architecture, because at the scale of the city is when you get to deal with issues around economics and politics, sociology, anthropology, all of these social science areas that I've always also found quite interesting. And so I basically look at the city as a kind of document that reveals to us what we believe in and what we hide from. You know, the city is full of segregation, is full of bias, is full of repression of people or of species. And so, you know, it's a very honest look at how societies work, both the good and the bad. And so that has long driven my interest in urban design. And then in terms of design thinking, as I looked at how systems weren't working well for many people, I realized that all of these systems, our political system, our economic system, our transportation system, our housing system, you name it, are all designed systems. And they're not working well for many people, as well as for the larger environment. And so design thinking is a way of applying design methods to bigger systems. So the kinds of things that an architect might do in the design of a building is what a design thinker might do in the redesign of our politics and the redesign of our transportation and the redesign of our land use policies or whatever the system is that isn't working well. So those are the reasons why I've focused on these issues in recent years.
Yeah, and I think on a design thinking level as well, our pandemic was a huge kind of eye-opener for that. And as I mentioned earlier, you are currently writing a new book based on a post-pandemic world. The concept alone has got me a little curious, so I want to ask how our land use and how our design thinking pre-pandemic held up to meet the requirements that COVID was demanding from our society? What were some of the realizations that came from analyzing our urban designs in a pandemic?
Well, the book is about the impact that these major historical events, these pandemics, have on societies. I look historically at the impact of the cholera epidemics, the mid-19th century, and how that shifted the way we think about cities. It forced us to require indoor plumbing and sanitary sewers and basically enabled us to have the dense industrial cities that characterized the second half of the 19th century. And a similar kind of impact happened in 1918 after the flu pandemic, where people, because it was a respiratory disease, people started to wear masks and social distance. And as a result of that, people started to desire to have their own private automobile and to live in single family houses with 6-foot setbacks from their neighbors. And so the suburbanization that characterized cities in the 20th century were largely triggered by a pandemic. So these pandemics, which come every 100 years or so, have enormous impacts on how we live our lives. And so the argument in the book is that in the post-pandemic, post-COVID-19 era that we are in, what has happened is a rebalancing of the digital and the physical world. In other words, we had a lot of technology that enabled us to do things remotely. And of course, some people were telecommuting and doing online shopping. But what pandemics do is rapidly accelerate us into the future. And so trends that were somewhat marginal prior to the pandemic immediately became the dominant way in which we worked, in which we shopped, in which we learned. And if the past is any indication of what our future will be, those changes will be permanent. In other words, we will all now have a choice about whether we go to a meeting in person or we Zoom in, whether we go to a store or we shop online, whether we go to a classroom or we, you know, study remotely. And because now there is more choice between whether we engage physically or digitally, it is going to have an enormous impact on the physical world. The physical world is now going to have to compete with the digital world for our attention and our time. That's a very different situation than has ever existed before. And so what it, I think, will mean is that we are going to have in the physical world experiences that you can't get online. In other words, let's take an office. I think we will see the end of the cubicle farms that characterized offices. People do not have to go 9 to 5 to sit in a cubicle and do something that they can do more productively at home. And so the office is going to be not this sort of repetitive, dreary place of production. It will probably be a place that will have good food, comfortable furniture, and be a place that people would want to go to,
want to work,
have meetings. Yeah. In other words, it will be an appealing place because people will have a choice about whether to go there or not. And we'll see that in every area of our economy. We'll see that with retail. We'll see that in restaurants. We'll see that in sports events. We will see all of these places having to compete and having to reimagine what the experience is that people will find there.
Yeah, I think you approach a topic that's really important when it comes to the digital world and the physical world. A lot of people don't actually have access, though, to the digital world. So still, it kind of puts up a little barrier in our own communities, in our own societies. So with this blank page that we're kind of given, innovation is a topic we explore often here on Behind the Podium. And I'd like to focus real quick on some of the principles you touch on in your previous book, Designing Our Way to a Better World, because you pose questions like, what if we serve the neediest among us who benefit the most from design without concern with receiving anything in return? It seems like we now have an opportunity to redesign our world for the better so we can get more people in touch with this digital world and more people kind of up to our standards on how we're going to approach this current workforce. And so what advice could you offer to those who share your aspirations of designing a better world? What principles should they focus on when designing in this world?
Right. Well, every pandemic reveals inequities. That was true of the previous pandemics, and it's certainly been true with this pandemic, right? We've realized the inequities in access to healthcare, the inequities in terms of the impact of the pandemic on people's health. But it also has, of course, revealed the inequities of access to the internet. And in an increasingly digitally based economy, not having high bandwidth access to the internet or a digital device to access it, that is a huge problem. And so the key infrastructure that we have to ensure that every single person has is good bandwidth connection and the devices they need to make that connection. And so we're involved in a project right now that is sort of reimagining how can we deliver high bandwidth access to the internet to every person through their streetlights, and how can digital devices become accessible to everybody. It turns out, though, many people actually do have smartphones. So that's getting to be very common across certainly the US population. But, you know, so how can these devices become less expensive and more accessible to everybody? Actually, the inequities that exist in this country around bandwidth isn't just in communities of color, say in urban areas, but also an urban-rural problem. There are many rural communities that have horrible access. And so just as in the 1930s, we had the goal of electrifying America and made sure that electricity was available to everybody, we now need to make the internet readily available to everybody in this country if they're going to participate in the economy. So in terms of the principles, I do think that the John Rawls idea in ethics about making decisions without knowing who you are, he talks about this veil of ignorance, that how would you make a decision if you might in fact be the poorest, most underserved person in the group. I mean, basically, he argued you would decide that every decision should benefit everybody, including the most underserved, the poorest among us. And I think that that is a principle that we need to follow in this post-pandemic era, which is who are the voices that aren't being heard? Who are those who are underserved, who have been treated inequitably in the past? And how do we make sure that whatever we do, that we're improving their lives? And so that's a pretty basic principle, I think, that we should follow.
Yeah, and it sounds like it should be something that shouldn't just be taught in an urban design class, though. It should be taught, you know, kind of throughout. So maybe it's your role and your position in University of Minnesota. Not only are you the director of Minnesota Design Center, but you're also a professor in the School of Architecture. How do you relate your courses on architecture to these principles you discuss? And what role could future architects or just future citizens play?
Well, that's a great point. I do agree with you. In fact, we have a grand challenge curriculum at the University of Minnesota where
I thought it was so interesting. If you could talk more about that as well.
Yeah. I mean, the idea there is we bring students from all different disciplines around some of these big challenges like equity, like health, like the post-pandemic future. I taught a class, co-taught a class like on that topic last summer. And so the idea here is that these are issues that every citizen should be thinking about working toward. In terms of my classes in the College of Design and the School of Architecture, I also believe strongly that professionals have an obligation to look after the most underserved in our communities. Professions are unlike businesses in that professions are supposed to look after the greater good and after the public's good. And so I think some professions take that more seriously than others. But I think every professional has a responsibility to ensure that the most underserved are their needs are being met. And that includes doing pro bono work. That means ensuring that decisions that you make benefit everybody and constantly taking into account those who are often not at the table.
Yeah, no, I think you summed that up very, very well. I always love talking to people who really, really do understand the issues at hand. And that makes my job so much more fun. But you also have this topic that you enjoy getting up and speaking about. It's called shared economy. And can you go a little bit more into detail about what that is? And does it tie into your latest research in a post-pandemic world?
Yes. Well, the sharing economy, again, is one of those phenomena that was underway prior to the pandemic, but of course was greatly accelerated because of the pandemic where, we had the delivery of goods to your doorstep prior to the pandemic, but that became during the pandemic the dominant way that many people got their groceries or anything delivered to them, right? And so I think that to me, what interests me about the sharing economy is the idea that we have overproduced almost everything, that we have incredible redundancy. And that suited the 20th century economy. We came out of World War II with this amazing industrial capacity and invented this idea of planned obsolescence because there was a concern that people would not buy enough to absorb all of the industrial production that the US was capable of. And so as part of the suburbanization that happened in the 20th century, we all believed that we all needed to own cars. We all needed to own washing machines. We all needed to have lawnmowers. The fact that there were maybe 20 lawnmowers on a block never occurred to us is that, you know, is this a little bit redundant? The fact that everybody had two or three cars sitting in garages and thinking, is this a bit of a waste of material here, all these parked cars? And so what the sharing economy began to ask is, well, what if we just networked and coordinated and shared things so that it's less about ownership and more about paying for what you need when you need it? It's more about access. So to me, the good side of the sharing economy is that it uses, you know, material resources much more efficiently, is much less wasteful, is much more affordable to people because you're only paying for what you need when you need it. And so it has a strong environmental and social justice component. There is, though, the dark side to it, which is that it has also become a place where people are exploited. The gig workers who are asked to partake in the sharing economy who don't have health benefits, who don't have any job security, and that are exploited, where they've got algorithms sort of tracking their deliveries, and they're fired if they don't make deliveries fast enough according to the algorithm. And so what happens frequently is that when there are big economic changes like this, it takes a while for public policy to catch up. And I think what we need to do is to acknowledge that the sharing economy is here to stay. And now we need policies that protect workers, that do not make gig workers so vulnerable, because there are certainly a lot of advantages to the sharing economy that we shouldn't turn away from.
Yeah. And as someone who was a gig worker during the pandemic, I personally experienced both the benefits of that type of work, as well as the vulnerabilities and challenges of it. So your call for policies to protect gig workers really resonates with me. And to your point, there wasn't really anyone making sure that I was being safe. They were just still exploiting me and
right,
profiting off my hard work. And, that's capitalism. And at the end of the day, it's a hard thing to fight. But to close this incredible interview out, let's enter a hypothetical and a way to sum it all up. The world is in your hands, Professor Fisher, and you get to design it. What does that world look like?
Well, the first thing I would do would be to say I'm not in the position to design this world, that I would develop large groups of diverse co-design teams with me. And I would have lots of people imagining what a better world would look like. And I would have them negotiating among themselves and see what kind of consensus emerged from a bottom-up co-design process in terms of how we can create better systems for people that are more equitable, more sustainable, more just, more affordable, and see where we get. I mean, I actually think one of the problems that we've inherited from the previous centuries is we think experts know what they're doing. And while they may have technical knowledge, by putting too much power in the hands of experts and those with political power, we've created a lot of dysfunction, a lot of unsustainable, inequitable situations for people. And so this is the century where we have to flip that, where we have to actually empower people with the most at stake in creating a better world and engage them in that co-design process. And we need then the professional communities to be open to that, to embrace that, to facilitate it, and to enable it to happen. Now, experts can help in terms of guidance, in terms of technical knowledge. So it's not as if expertise doesn't have a role. But the last thing you want to do is to put the design of the world in the hands of anybody that thinks they're an expert.
Absolutely. I was about to say that I think the thing that stood out to me the most was how immediately you said, I'm going to relinquish that power and I'm going to get a whole board of so-called experts, and then we're going to collaborate some ideas on it.
And the more diverse, the better. The best ideas come from as many different perspectives as possible.
Yeah. I think if you decided to rule the world, I'd be okay with it, though. But you have the power to let power go, and I think that is amazing. I think that's a great place for us to stop. Thomas, thank you so much for joining me today. This next 30 seconds is for you to promote and plug whatever you have going on in your life. And again, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you, Jasper. So, well, we continue to do this work at the Minnesota Design Center. I have a book coming out with from Rutledge in early 2022 on the post-pandemic city. And our work at the Minnesota Design Center is also looking at what the post-pandemic office, what the post-pandemic home, what the post-pandemic store, all of those issues, what they will look like. And so we continue to do this work, and it's a lot of fun.
Thank you again. Make sure you guys check him out. The links to his socials will be in the description below. And if you haven't already signed up, make sure you check out his keynote speech on July 21st at our new event, Changing the Landscape of Land Use, a conference about equity and sustainability in land use. Thanks for listening to Behind the Podium, a podcast series brought to you by Fusion Learning Partners. Visit our website, fusionlp.org, for the full lineup of podcasts and for all the exciting events we have coming up.